I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on General Government Consumer Protection for this Wednesday, February 15, 2012. We're going to have a public hearing and possible work session on two Senate bills today, committee members. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1535. Jen, would you care to give us a brief description of this Senate bill?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 1535 authorizes affordable housing covenants that are contained in a recorded master form instrument to be incorporated by reference in a short form instrument recorded for a real property transaction. There are no amendments, there's no revenue impact, there's no fiscal impact, and there's no subsequent referral.
Great. Maybe we, is there anybody signed up to testify that can explain something about master form instruments to us? Jill Gray and Jesse Thiessen?
Hi.
Welcome, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Co-Chair Holy, Co-Chair Wisnett, and members of the committee, my name is Jill Gray, and I'm the legislative aide for Senator Jackie Dingfelder. And with me is Jesse Beeson from Proud Ground, and Jesse is the person with whom we've worked on this bill. And I'm sorry that Senator Dingfelder is unable to be here, but she's in her own committee at the moment, and she asked if I would just come over to introduce the bill and explain a little bit about how we arrived at Senate Bill 1535. In the 2007 session, Senator Dingfelder introduced a bill regarding affordable housing covenants, and very quickly, that just means that an affordable home, when the homeowner leaves or moves out of the home goes to another lower or moderate income Oregonian, and that way the home always stays in the affordable housing stock. And about a year and a half ago or so, it was in 2010, Jesse from Proud Ground contacted our office and said that they had an idea for legislation that would somewhat build on the previous work we had done with affordable housing covenants, and that idea is Senate Bill 1535. I know it can be a confusing bill, but here's my best shot at explaining it. Affordable housing, affordable homes, just like any home, has to have documents recorded, but those documents can frequently be much longer and more complex than the documents for a typical market rate home. The affordable housing community knows that there have been some instances in Oregon when affordable housing documents have not been recorded at all, and probably more instances when there were errors in the documentation. With Senate Bill 1535, we want to encourage the recording of affordable housing documents to make sure investments in affordable housing are properly recorded in the public domain. To do that, this bill will allow the recording of a master short form for affordable homes. A master short form will mean that the longer affordable housing document will only need to be recorded once, and then if anything happens, such as a transfer of the property, you can record a shorter form, which will refer to the longer document. I realize even with this explanation, Senate Bill 1535 can be a little confusing, and so as I was trying to think, how can I explain this differently, I thought, you know, what we really want to know is, why is this bill important? Why is it needed? And I would say that primarily it's because we want to protect the investments we've already made in affordable housing. Because those documents can be quite long and complex, there are times we know then that those affordable housing documents are not being recorded and thus endangering the investments we've made. And we want to encourage the exact opposite. We want to make sure those affordable housing documents are recorded. And the bill allowing a short form will hopefully alleviate some of the challenges to recording of those documents. I would also say that a secondary reason is just to try and decrease the errors that frequently find their way into affordable housing documents. A few last points to consider before I turn it over to Jesse is that we were asked this question by several different people, and that is, how does this bill affect the document recording fee? And the answer is, it doesn't. And if any committee members have questions about that, I will leave it to Jesse to explain how the document recording fee works, but I wanted to make sure we hit that point. The second thing is, Oregon law already allows a master short form, except the statute says that it only allows it for trust deeds. And with this bill, we'd like to have statutes say that you can also use a master in short form for affordable housing documents. The last point is, there is no known opposition to this bill, and I know that Co-Chair Wisnett had a question about that, and even after checking in with the people suggested, I still do not know of any opposition to this bill. And with that, I will turn it over to Jesse.
Great. Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnant, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 1535. My name is Jesse Beeson. I'm the Executive Director of Proud Ground. Proud Ground is a nonprofit organization helping low and moderate income families buy their first home in Multnomah and Washington counties. In 13 years, we've served more than 150 first-time homebuyers. We join public agencies and other nonprofits that do so by using federal and local subsidy to invest in the long-term affordability of our homes, ensuring that generations of Oregonians have access to affordable homeownership. To protect that public subsidy, homeowners sign affordability agreements that are attached to the home. These agreements are complex, and because they are executed every time a home is sold or a new home buyer buys a home, document and recording errors can occur easily. And sometimes, as Jill mentioned, some organizations aren't recording these documents at all. So errors and a lack of recording can put the public subsidy at risk. And in fact, though it was not with one of our homes, public subsidy has been lost when a home was foreclosed against the affordability agreement, which hadn't been recorded. Senate Bill 1535 is a simple fix that would help solve this. With this bill, a long affordability agreement, called the Master Agreement, can be recorded just once for all home buyers under a particular program, and then a much shorter agreement for each specific home buyer is recorded that binds the short agreement to the long agreement. It ensures that affordability agreements remain consistent over time, ensuring that no homeowner is treated differently, no costly mistake is made, and no public subsidy is lost when an agreement goes unrecorded. Jill mentioned that Oregon already allows this arrangement between master and short form with trustees, and we think that a simple addition through Senate Bill 1535 can extend this practice to the affordability agreements that public agencies and nonprofits use. Most importantly, this fix will have no impact on document recording fees that fund affordable housing. We urge and thank you for your support of Senate Bill 1535.
Questions from the committee? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jesse, thank you for bringing this bill forth. I'm a big supporter of trying to help people get in homes, and I'm also a big supporter of Habitat for Humanity. I'm assuming both of you in this current economic situation are having some foreclosures. Can you tell the committee, you know, what's your rate or how's with your low-cost housing, and any comments you want to make about the foreclosure of people getting into your program?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. To date, Proud Ground has not actually had a single family lose their home through foreclosure. We think part of that is because we make homes affordable from the get-go, and we also provide a lot of counseling and education to ensure that folks aren't getting any crazy loans or anything like that. And nationally, organizations like ours are about seven times less likely to experience a foreclosure. I don't know offhand Habitat's rate, but I know it's pretty low as well. It's not to say that the economy hasn't affected our families, but luckily, if and when they're faced with a hardship, they're often contacting us to see what their options are, and indeed many of them are able to keep and stay in their homes.
Well, thank you very much for those comments. Maybe we could employ you statewide to help your organization, your nonprofit, to help our situation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Smith.
Good bill. I noticed a little Scrivener's error. I'm having a hard time finding it now. It needed a 2 after applies, but now I can't find it. Maybe they corrected it in the current version. But it's a small thing. I wanted to put it on the record. And if I find it, I will show it to you for fixing or to Legislative Council, because I'm sure it was not your error.
You better be quick.
Everybody lost focus. Can't find it.
So, can you tell me a little bit more about the master form?
Sure.
And that it, so when you have something recorded with a particular property, the short form refers to this master form that's also recorded at the county?
Yeah.
And is it associated with the master form? Does it reference all the different properties that it applies to?
It would not. So it would... The master agreement generally runs between 30 and 40 pages, depending on, you know, each particular organization, how they might put their document together. So that 40-page document gets recorded once in the county in which the program operates. And then as each family purchases a home or a home is resold, then a much shorter document, generally around 2 to 4 pages, is recorded that basically instructs any reader to go to the master document, and where it sees home buyer, put in this family's name. Where it sees address, please put in this address. Where it sees purchase price, please put in this purchase price. And so that's a lot easier document for folks to digest. And then, of course, our families receive the master agreement. It is the only copy of the recorded, or not the only copy, but it is the copy of the recorded long instrument. So we know there's no errors being made.
Okay. Representative Smith.
I found it. Short-form instrument means a short-form mortgage, a short-form trust deed, or any instrument that documents a real estate transaction that incorporates by reference and applies to all, I think, all or any affordable housing covenants created in a recorded master form instrument into the transaction. Right now it reads applies
line,
all.
Line 13,
section 2. Subsection 2, section 2, subsection 2, line 13 of the document.
I'd be fine with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a small thing. But.
Nice.
So noted.
Might as well read one bill before I leave this chamber.
A little joke. None of us recognize that. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And with that, I'll close the public hearing. And due to Jefferson's sharp eye there, I think maybe we will not move this bill at the moment and see if we can quickly get an amendment to correct that language if in fact everybody recognizes that Scrivener's error.
I would assume they also take an amendment.
I think a Scrivener's error, we can take a real-time amendment. I think that's an exception to typical practice. Mm-hmm. I would move for suspension of the rules, recess if we need to, but suspension of the rules to allow for an insertion of the word two between applies and all in section two, subsection two of the bill.
Why don't you check with the clerk?
I appreciate your efforts, but I'm not going to go that direction. I will do it in a much more deliberate fashion, just to make sure that we're all on the same page with this. So, and we have time to get this done, so I'm not too worried about it stopping the bill. Any other questions? Oh, Representative Clem.
Just for your information, I once had something like this happen in my committee, and I believe LC will tell you they have the power to fix this without any amending at all later, and then we don't have to go through the concurrence motion and all that stuff.
We'll get the answers to all those things and bring it back to the next meeting.
Sharing my knowledge.
Thank you. Well, appreciate your knowledge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, Mr. Chair, applies all to are two different, they mean two different things, so I think we need to make sure that that's really clarified.
Yes.
Yeah, make sure.
So with that, I think I already closed this public hearing.
You did.
So I don't know why we're still talking about it. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing for Senate Bill 1537.
It might be correct. It's good not to insert the change. You made a good decision, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 1537 prescribes the procedure and the form of notice for a cemetery authority to follow when disposing of abandoned burial spaces. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued, and there is no subsequent referral.
Great. Can we have up Randy Tucker? Paul?
Sliman? Tim Farrell.
And Tim Farrell. Just enough room for all three of you. Good afternoon. Seems like I started the day talking about cemeteries and things like that, and I'm ending the day that way. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, I'm Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. With me to my right is Paul Sliman, who is the Director of our Department of Parks and Environmental Services. That's the Department of Metro that operates our cemetery program, and I thought we'd let Paul make some introductory comments, and I can kind of walk you through the bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Randy. Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Sliman. I work for Metro, and I'm here to voice my support for Senate Bill 1537, which will allow cemeteries the opportunity to reclaim purchased and unused burial rights that have gone unused for 50 or more years. You may know Metro operates 14 pioneer cemeteries, the majority of which were established in the late 1800s, a few of which predate statehood. We inherited these from Multnomah County about 15 years ago, and we operate these as community jewels. We provide burial space, access to nature, and areas of quiet reflection, but these are not museums. We do operate these cemeteries, and on any given year, we're doing up to 200 burial services. We have a very common situation, which is that the original purchasers of these burial spaces may have been interred elsewhere, they have not been found, nor have their descendants been found, and they're difficult, or if not impossible, for us to locate. This may not appear to be a problem, but it does exert considerable pressure on cemeteries such as ours that are surrounded on all sides by homes, schools, churches, or businesses. And we do not intend to expand the footprint of these cemeteries if it's unnecessary. We have stopped selling burial rights in two of our most popular cemeteries, and we would like to pursue the original owners or their descendants to determine their level of interest in exercising their purchased rights. The present process that would allow us to do that is outdated and expensive. So we've worked with the Cemetery Association of Oregon, as well as others, to create what we believe is an improved process. It will apply to cemeteries across our state as an optional opportunity for them to notify original purchasers or their descendants, determine their ultimate burial desires, and if appropriate, reclaim that purchase right for other community members to exercise. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker again, Metro. I just was going to briefly walk you through the sheet that I distributed, which has more detail than you possibly would want to know, I would imagine, about the process. But I'd just like to give you a couple of the highlights. First of all, proposal before you in the form of Senate Bill 1537 reflects very closely the recommendations from the International Cemetery Cremation and Funeral Association about how to reclaim abandoned burial rights. Those model guidelines don't have any timelines and dates in them, but they basically reflect the process that's before you today. What we're trying to do is basically make burial spaces available to the community once again, and this is the way that we think is the best to do it. There are a couple of reasons why this proposed process is actually better for any owners of graves that we may be able to find. One is that there's a greater time period of no contact before this process can be invoked in the first place that is proposed in this bill, as opposed to the current law, which in this bill is 50 years and current law it's 40 years. There's also this bill provides for greater notice to any existing owners that can be reached or found, and it also provides a remedy in the unlikely event that somebody does turn up after a grave has been resold. It provides a remedy that is better than under existing law by making available a burial space to those people. The back of the sheet gives you a sort of a blow-by-blow, side-by-side description of the current process versus the process we're proposing. The current process that exists is not available to all cemeteries because of the rationale that underlies it, which is a nuisance rationale, and it also involves much higher costs to the cemetery owner and to the public because it uses the court system, sheriffs, it requires auctions on the courthouse steps and foreclosures and liens and all kinds of other sort of conflict-laden processes which are not part of what we're proposing today. So in summary, I would just recommend this bill to you as something that is better for both the public interest and for an owner of an existing burial right, and that will make it possible to make more burial spaces available to the community if they need them. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Farrell, would you like to provide us any testimony?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Tim Farrell of Hood River, Oregon. I've been running a nonprofit historic cemetery there for the past 20 years. I'm also secretary of the Cemetery Association of Oregon. There are probably about 40 or 50 large cemeteries across the state that may be able to use this process, but it's not a process that is required of all cemeteries to use. My cemetery, we do about 10 burials a year. Our expenses are about $3,000 a year, and we bring in last year about $2,900. So this is not a big we're not a big thriving business. We survive a lot on the donations and volunteer help from the community. A typical thing, and I happen to have one. It's a deed from the Knights of Pythias to Mr. Dodge from the Waucoma Knights for $5 for a what we call a lot of graves, which is 10 plots in that lot. So this is a 1908 deed, I guess. And there's a notation on it from one of the family members saying this plot is donated back to the cemetery by Weston Dodge of Eugene, Oregon. And I think this is kind of the classic thing. There's no Dodges around in Hood River, Oregon. There's none even buried on my property. They've moved to Eugene, and yet, and the family, in fact, has no plans on burying members of the family back in Hood River. Presumably they'll all be buried in the Eugene area, and they've very graciously offered to give back these plots to the cemetery. Now, I can't really take this to the bank and go out and sell these, though, because I'd have to go into the probate records and so on to find out if this Mr. Dodge actually has title and is able to do what the notation says. Under the current system, I basically wouldn't be able to get these plots back in order to sell them to a Hood River family who may own burial areas around this one, which appears to have been abandoned. But this process, which Metro has worked on, and I think it's a very good system, will allow maybe not me to do this, but if a family comes to me and says, we want to get these graves here, I say, no, they belong to the Dodges, but they've been abandoned. But here's a system now that I can point these individual families to in order to make these graves available to them. So this legislation will be helping members of the public who want to keep their families, remains local, something that we couldn't do before. So I thank you for giving this testimony, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to respond.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, you're interested, you said you're from the Historical Society, you're from Historical. Does the Oregon, any of the grave sites we're talking about, are they reviewed or looked at for historical value? And like, three graves or four graves in the middle of Crosswater Golf Course of a historical sign died on the train, the trail over. How are those historical, or is there a review of the burial plots to be sure there's no historical value or something to them? Is that?
Well, I can only really say why my cemetery is historic, which is because Nathaniel Coe, who was an esteemed member of the legislature in the state of New York for many years before moving to Oregon, and founded Hood River. So he was buried there on my property. He was a big Whig. He was an anti-Mason, and there was only one other cemetery, which was run by the Masons. So. His family buried him at the Knights of Pythias Cemetery. So there is a process. Now, how we got our historic designation was through the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And so we submitted an application, and they agreed that his site and where his family is was of significance to the state. And so they gave us that designation.
Follow up. I guess, Randy, then, you know, I'm saying is in Portland Metro, are they, is there any way to look at these grave sites as you're getting rid of them or banning them after 50 years, that there is some, you know, is there any historical value in this person or this grave site being retained, I guess, would be a question.
Mr. Co-Chair, Holvey, Culture, Wisden, let me just clarify for the record that this only applies to graves that are not used. This process would not affect any grave in which a burial has occurred.
Okay.
So the example that you gave, which sounds a little bit non-standard because it doesn't sound like it's actually in a cemetery, but if it were in a cemetery, you know, this legislation would not apply to it at all if people have actually been buried there. This is only empty
lots.
Graves that have been purchased but
thank
not
you.
Used.
Thank you for clarifying.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks. To me, the key question, maybe the key two questions, is 50 years long enough and is 90 days long enough? My instinct is that the 50 years is not long enough, and I'll say why I think so. So my own, so my folks got married 51 years ago. My dad's still alive. From my understanding, he could lose his burial plot if he had failed to provide the cemetery change of address form, or, as many people would do, put his deed in his safe deposit box, thinking, I'm never going to have to touch this again, and when I pass away, they'll have accessed my safe deposit box, open it up, find the instructions, and oops, there was a 90-day notice that we might not have received, and because people move around a little bit. If we had it at 60 years, so my challenge with 50 years is that anybody who got married before the age of 30 and lived past the age of 80, which, by the way, is a lot of people, would potentially still be alive when we try to take away their plot. If we moved it to 60 or 75 years, I think we would lower the number of people significantly who would be impacted in a negative way. And the second is the 90 days. I mean, this is the kind of thing. This is not like paying a credit card bill or a phone bill that you do. You know, you buy a cemetery plot. My guess is you never want to think about it again until you really have to. And so those are my concerns.
I've just got a quickie, which is that we're not going to go out wholesale and just do this process.
Oh, I get that.
Okay.
Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, I guess I'll try to respond. The 50-year threshold only enables you, first of all, you have to have had no record of any contact for that entire 50 years. And then it enables you to just initiate a process which involves an effort to find the owners. So the legislation actually requires certified mail as well as email and telephone attempts if those ways of contacting the person are possible. So we would anticipate a fairly serious effort to find these people, and certainly wouldn't anticipate any kind of cavalier approach to reclaiming graves. And we have very few graves actually in that 50 to 75 year window at any rate. But I would just note that the 50 years doesn't mean that somebody's going to lose their burial space. It means that we have to then undertake a process which involves trying to find them.
So I don't anticipate it to be cavalier. In fact, what I would anticipate is you'd follow those three steps, and you'd find the phone number has changed in the last 50 years, right, almost for sure. Otherwise, it's easy to find them. You'll find out they didn't have an email address 50 years ago, and you'll find out that if they moved, it won't be the same address, and they might not have offered forwarding information. So I don't believe it'll be going around gathering plots, nor do I believe it'll impact thousands of people. But, you know, working for the worst or, you know, not as good case scenario sort of seems like why we sit here. And if there isn't, and I don't think I'm springing this on you now. I think
no,
it
no,
raises
no.
essentially the same
right.
concerns we spoke before.
Right.
And if there are a relatively small number of plots we're talking about between that window, I see few costs to the legislation to shift the number of years. Right. If it doesn't impact your world that much, we could provide a little more certainty and safety to some number of families if we made a change.
Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, I can say that a change in the number of years probably doesn't affect Metro in a significant way. I can't speak for the Cemetery Association of Oregon. I do know that when we first began to put this together, it was last session in 2011, it came up because there was unrelated legislation. Actually, it was Tim's legislation having to do with a completely different cemetery-related issue. The relating clause of the bill was relating to historic cemeteries, which would work great for us, but I know that there are non-historic cemeteries that also would like to be able to use this process, and so I would defer to others on the number of years. On the number of days, I think, you know, we certainly could be flexible there. The question is what would be an appropriate number of days to wait? So, you know, I don't think that's any kind of a make or break issue for us. You know, we've been waiting a long, over 50 years. Another 30 days is probably not a problem. I'd say there's just a question about timing in the legislative process, and I can, you know, it's a pretty simple amendment. So I think we're at your service on that.
Thanks. Further questions on this grave issue?
Oh.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy, we talked in the hallway about something I think is good to put on the record. I mentioned this Department of State Lands typically deals with unclaimed property. Can you tell the committee a little bit about what you found out there and why that wasn't the proper place to go?
Thank you. I appreciate the question, Representative Holvey, Representative Sheehan. The nature of these of what we're talking about here has been an interesting question. Is this real estate? Is this personal property? What is it? And at any rate, what we're talking about is a burial right. But we did check with the Division of State Lands, Department of State Lands, I guess they are now. And I spoke to Louise Soliday in November, and I've shared this information with the co-chairs as well. And I have a quote from an email from her that's in the memo that I gave to the co-chairs back in November, which says, "We have reviewed and discussed this, and DSL does not have any concerns from an unclaimed property perspective." I'm not sure that answers a question about what, you know, the nature of the rights are, but at any rate, I've run it past DSL, and I think we don't have a conflict there. Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Believe it or not, I kind of understand this situation because my mom's been trying to get me to take over a family cemetery that my family donated in the 1800s, and I have lots of relatives buried there, and we have 21 plots still. But 50 years has kind of brought up with us having 21 plots, thinking about that process, and there's lots of other family members, historic families that are in this cemetery that we have, and keeping track of all of them. And I'm just wondering, 50 years seems like an awful short time. Is this something that you've ran into with your cemetery, or would you be open to 75 years, what Representative Smith was kind of getting at? Is there a significance how that 50 years was picked for this?
I'd have to defer to Randy Tucker on that one as to the amount of time, but certainly, you know, the historic cemetery that I have, you know, 50 years, 75 years would be fine. This one happens to be from 1905. This was kind of the biggest one that I found. So, you know, and these people, in my experience, most of these people that aren't using these after, you know, so long, because the families have moved away. But well, you know, I understand if your experience is different.
If I may follow up, most of yours is probably on big pieces of paper drawn out with the plots, or?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, which is another problem in and of itself, keeping track of.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the thought of Representative Widener owning a cemetery, I thought that'd be a great place for some of those bill files to go. But I joked to my colleague, because he's been successful passing two legislative priorities this session, and I commend him for that great effort.
Two.
I want to make sure. Yes, absolutely. But I want to make sure that I just get on the record.
You passed them both. I want to thank you for that, Chair Holvey.
Sorry. Thank you. I just want to put on the record, I appreciate the time that we spent today. I want to make sure that we understand you know, the importance of the issue at hand. Gresham has a Pioneer Cemetery. We had talked before about Powell Boulevard. It's off Walters Road right by West Gresham. And interesting note, the first, believed to be the first Japanese person to ever live in Oregon is buried in that cemetery. And that is Mayo Iwakashi. just for the record. I understand what Representative Smith's trying to accomplish from a 50 to more, but I'm supportive of this concept, and I think we should move this bill. I like it. Thanks, guys, for bringing it forward.
Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill, especially in terms of the 50 to 75 years? Seeing no one else, I'm going to close the public hearing. And I'm going to choose not to work this bill right at the moment, too, so we can discuss Representative Smith's concept. I think he does raise a valid point that maybe we should just think about for a little bit before we move this bill.
Yeah. Were zombies included in the work group?
So, did I close the public hearing?
They would like to come back and address that. Scrivener's error, they don't see as a scrivener's error. So reopen the public hearing.
Okay.
Zombies.
So I did close the public hearing. So I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1535 and call back up Jesse Beeson and Jill.
Great. I think it's not an error after all.
Do we need to bring a legislative counsel in to explain to Jefferson what this means?
No, I think I caught it myself. I think it's okay.
I think, just for the record, Co-Chairs Holby, Co-Chair Wiston, that there is not a Scribner's error by my reading of the bill, but I appreciate the careful reading by the representative.
Ooh, I wasn't careful of
it. Oh. I got too excited.
So so would you like to go over that sentence with us to tell us what that means without the two?
Yeah, so it's really saying that any real estate instrument that includes provisions of the Affordable Housing Covenant. So it's that whole clause is really describing the short form instrument. It's the two is not an accurate would not make that an accurate clause, if that makes sense. So in particular, I'm reading from line 12, and actually, yeah, line 12. Any instrument that documents a real estate transaction that incorporates by reference and applies all or any affordable housing covenants.
Yeah.
That's the important clause. The two would actually sever that relationship.
Great.
Harvard.
I'll defer to their reading. Sounds great.
Harvard English Department.
Good undergrad.
I figured I read this bill so many times, I hopefully would have caught that, but
I appreciate that. I was cautious of jumping into changing that right away without checking with legislative counsel on what that actually meant. So I assume that you went through that process and got back here right away.
We sure did.
Appreciate that. Representative Widener, comment? Question?
No, I think our Harvard attorney has got it under control now.
It is...
You're one for two.
Thank you very much for that. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1535. And it... we'll go ahead and open the work session on Senate Bill 1535.
Chair.
Senator Wisnett.
I move Senate Bill 1535 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wisnett moves Senate Bill 1535 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, shall we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Clement.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisden.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye. Senate Bill 1535, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. I think we ought to have Representative Smith carry this on the floor.
Thanks. I'd be happy to carry that to the floor.
You can carry all of them.
Close the work session. Work session on Senate Bill 1535 and adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer
Do I need to carry it over 1357?
No, we'll just reissue.
We're closed.
Okay.